Friends buy me tiny Eiffel Towers, and my husband knows he's safe if he buys me any object, garment, wine, or pastry said to be French. I've always been drawn to French culture, by which I, of course, mean French literature, art, music, and philosophy, but mainly, because I'm a shallow American, French food, wine, perfume, couture, and lifestyle. And so, as a shallow American who romanticizes French culture, I was the perfect target for Emily in Paris. People kept telling me about the show, saying I'd love the clothes, the gorgeous Parisian setting, the too familiar marketing and social media themes. I refused to watch. Critics had panned the show as frothy, vapid, ridden with cliches. I staged a private boycott, reluctant to see Paris, my Paris, the snow globe miniature inside my head, trashed by idiocy. Years passed. This August, The Week announced the fourth season, noting that audience response was so strong, the show just could not be canceled. Critics be damned. This did stir a grudging admiration. And a day later, a smart, young, male friend, not the usual recommendation source, emailed to say he thought I would like this show called Emily in Paris. My choice was clear: be insulted at the very notion, or cave. I watched the first season, rolled my eyes, sighed, and watched the second season. I slid into the third without hesitation. By the time I started the fourth season, I had fallen, as indiscriminately as Emily, in love. But not for the usual reasons. Emily's clothes are too costumey for my taste. I'd prefer the wardrobe from Queen's Gambit, if anyone's offering. Emily's Paris is too perfect, with plenty of moonlit bridge scenes overlooking the Seine, but none of the grit of the 10th arrondissement or the spunk of the garbage collector strikes. And hearing French spoken well is lovely, but Emily should know more of it by now. This lag is precisely the spoiled, blithe attitude that initially dismayed me. I've always loathed the writing convention that insists on torturing the main character, ratcheting the misery higher with each episode. But in this case, Emily had to suffer. Once her sweet little heart was smashed into smithereens, the camera could pan out to other, more interesting characters. The show really is well acted, and much of the dialogue is clever, if not cerebral. Now that my annoyance had melted away, I could even like Emily. She is not the brightest sparkler in the parade. One critic remarked that she had the education of a golden retriever. But she is resilient. In catastrophes, her eyes widen, but she does not sink into self-pity. She tilts her head and offers a new, better idea. Often these ideas are either over-elaborate or over-simple, and I do worry about her career future. But I love her refusal to be cast down, rejected, ignored, or foiled. After all the reports of rising anxiety, loneliness, and suicide among young people, I clutched every time something went wrong for her, then exhaled in relief. Emily has a bubble bath version of grit, and it's delightful and reassuring to watch. The next time I feel left-footed, embittered, or thwarted, I will Instagram something clever and wait for a creative epiphany. Somehow I think that sort of playfulness would be easier to achieve if I lived in a city where bosses insisted on a long, relaxed, savored lunch, and refused to talk business after hours. A city where people were comfortable with sex and the body, respected themselves enough to cultivate a sense of style, and were willing to make gloriously messy mistakes for adventure's sake, rather than play it safe. The show's pointed French-American contrasts made me wince, not because they were clichés, but because so many of them rang true. The rah-rah, conformist, profit-hungry corporate style in the U.S. might be a stereotype, but I've lived inside that stereotype. I prefer the French disdain for bland conformity, fitness fads, easy clicks, and unrefined greed. Still, what I really fell in love with was the youth of Emily and her friends. Like Sylvie, her 50-something boss, I watched their antics with nostalgia, wry amusement, exasperation, and hard-swallowed envy. Not that I would want to be young again. But the show brought back all the energy, drama, angst, excitement, and wide-open possibility that marked my 20s. My friends and I were so close then, entangled in one another's lives, offering constant support. Watching Emily, I find myself missing that intensity, that wild energy and involvement. Today's crises are illnesses, divorces, downsizings. It is no fun and pointless to stay up all night together trying to solve them. We need one another more than ever, but not in that fresh, distractible even from misery, always ready for fun way. We are settled, mired in our own lives, routines, and preferences. That burst of young, confused joie de vivre was the escape Emily in Paris offered me. But an uneasy question lingered. What did the French think of this show? Well, you know the sweet little bakery where Emily and her friends buy croissants? Its window was spray-painted Emily Not Welcome. Parisians called the Emily-seeking tourism invasion of the imbeciles. Radio host Laurence Boccolini said, in a lousy online translation, I'm sure, I have not had mirthless laughters like this since the scene in which Carrie Bradshaw in beret and heels walks in dog poop. Which makes sense. Emily director Darren Star also created Sex and the City. After complaining of all the stereotypes of the French, lazy, snide, unclean, over-amorous, Boccolini said, Bravo, Netflix France, and bravo to the director to have put more grotesque clichés on the French and Parisians than KK on his personal Insta. That's fair. The clichés do flow like champagne. But the indignant, cerebral responses of the French also suit the stereotype. One commenter was weary of the trope that Frenchmen are always trying to flirt, but then pointed out that the show's loudish depictions lacked finesse and subtlety. Well, subtle sophistication and the nuanced double entendre are also a cliché. That, however, is a cliché they like to claim. Like intellectual depth, artistic refinement, and the coffee snobbery that makes the same commenter say, it's rather peculiar that Emily chooses to take Starbucks when she's in goddamn Paris. French perfumer Francis Kurjak, I'm going to mess up his name, I can't say it, was the inspiration for one episode. You know who I'm talking about, Baccarat Rouge. In a recent New Yorker profile, without any reference to Emily, he summed up the distinctions the show tries to make, often clumsily, between French and American attitudes toward work, love, marketing, the internet, and life. In France, he remarks, perfumers are allowed to have what we call fulgurance, or lightning flashes of inspiration. But in the mid-90s in the U.S., you got a bunch of marketing briefs where you were told something like, so, there's a high-income WASP living in Baltimore, driving this type of car and playing tennis, and can you create the perfume of that? 3 decades later, we do know better. I watched all those glamorous promotional parties that American Emily staged with sheer relief that I will never have to go to one again. But many of our most creative, mentally agile young people are as swept up as she is, and there's an opportunity cost. Emily could easily outstrip a golden retriever if she were not so busy taking aren't I cute, look how much fun I'm having selfies that will make teenage girls hate their lives. Even fluff can cut to the quick. And how can I know all this and still look forward to season 5? Glamour, beauty, romance, drama, laughter, champagne, these props are persuasive, even in late middle age and even in arch, jaded Paris. A critic for Le Monde felt justifiably queasy after season 1. Quote, as if I had eaten all the macaroons in the box by myself. But the people have spoken. After season 4 hit Netflix last month, guess what shot to the top of France's most watched list?